this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 20th, 2009, and this is show number 224. I know I keep saying the show's going to be a marathon, but this time I really mean it. Bart and I had a great conversation and chit-chat across the pond, and when we checked the time, it was 47 minutes long. Well, I queried Twitter to see if we should release it as its own episode, but the vote was overwhelmingly that we should keep it in the same show. Here's a sampling of responses I received. At Todd McCann said, go for the long episode. This trucker needs content. Big in Virginia said, you know, I would love the long podcast. 90 minutes would be great. Elliot MB said, I think it's better to keep them together. I like to have everything in one go. It's like a NoCillaCast-a-thon. Desert Salt said, start a new podcast. Chit-chat across the pond. Tenex said, go long. iPods have pause buttons. And Beaupierre said, go for the director's cut length. Well, the fans have spoken. Here is the NoCillaCast-a-thon. Well, today is a very special day in the Twitterverse because it's Ozrose's birthday. That's at Ozrose on, at twitter.com/Ozrose. Rose has become a dear friend to both Steve and I over the past couple of years, a frequent contributor to the show, and a stalwart attendee of the live show. To commemorate such an important and auspicious occasion, Steve and I created a little birthday video for her. Unless you're a serious crankpot, you will not be able to watch this video without laughing, or at least smiling hard, as Don McAllister said, after he watched it. I embedded the video in the show notes, and if you haven't seen it already, even if you have, head on over to watch it for some high-level silliness. I recommend it highly. Well, I mentioned a few shows back that the one single thing that keeps me on Firefox over Safari is a plugin called FlashBlock. This indispensable plugin does what you'd imagine. It blocks Flash until you ask for it. If you navigate to YouTube, nothing can autoplay. You see a big Flash arrow where videos should be, and all you have to do is click on the one you want to get it to play. Now, that sounds kind of silly on YouTube when you're pretty likely to want to watch something, but what about if you're like on LATimes.com or something and there's great content you want to read, but you're distracted by some Flash ad going on? No more with FlashBlock from addons.mozilla.org. I almost said MozillaCast. Anyway, some time ago, someone suggested Glimmer Blocker for Safari, but I wasn't fond of it, and when I removed it as a preference pane, it left some trash behind that acted like a DNS redirect. Bart and I saw that virus-like behavior and had to do some real sleuthing to be sure I wasn't actually infected by something. Obviously, that's not quite a good solution. Well, a while back, Paul from Peru, known for his Spanish and German Honda Bob commercials, heard me whining about the lack of FlashBlock for Safari, and he wrote in to suggest an app, a little plugin called Click to Flash, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce the URL for this. It has a whole bunch of consonants all run together that I can't say out loud. Anyway, there is a link to that in the show notes, of course. I threw it on my machine because, well, I'll load just about anything someone tells me is good, but I never wrote back to him because I didn't notice any difference in my browsing experience, and I didn't have the energy to go poking around looking for it about figuring out how to make it go. Plugin shouldn't require any kind of manual, in my opinion, so I wasn't even thinking of going looking for one. Well, a few weeks later, Paul wrote back asking if Click to Flash had worked for me. I was about to write a sad little message back about it when I opened Safari, only to find that now every place Rogue or even Requested Flash was supposed to play, I saw a pleasant gray rectangle that simply says Flash in the middle of it. I put screenshots in the show notes of both FlashBlock on Firefox and Click to Flash on Safari, and the pictures are almost identical. I'm so glad Paul sent this along to me. Now I feel free to use Safari without the extremely heavy and compute-intensive load that Flash brings with it, not to mention how intrusive it can be sometimes. One last bit on Click to Flash. I've mentioned lots of times that I use a tool called Feeder to create the show notes, basically writing the HTML that goes on the website. I'll imagine my surprise when I put the YouTube embed code into Feeder for Rose's birthday video, and I went to the preview mode on Feeder, and it showed me the Click to Flash symbology for the Flash video. I'm guessing that maybe Click to Flash is a hack for WebKit, the engine that's underneath Safari, and that Feeder must use WebKit to render the web preview too. I'll have to check with Steve Harris of reinventedsoftware.com to find out about that. Last week, John asked a dumb question about a problem he was having with Mozy backups. He suspected that his backups were taking forever, or not succeeding because Mosey might be seeing his iPhoto library as one giant file, so any minor edit to a photo in that library would cause the entire gigabytes of his entire library to have to be re-uploaded again. I told him I thought he was right and also said that's probably why my super-duper backup is so slow, since I have 80 gigabytes of photos in Aperture, which is also stored as a single package file. Well, even on dumb questions, I can be wrong. I got this email from Debbie T. of splashofstyle.com, and she actually tipped me off to where I might be wrong. I know, hard to believe. That's never happened before, right? Here's what she wrote. I use ChronoSync, and one of the settings is to dissect packages, so it syncs and changes only the files that are changed, not the whole package. I bet that Mosey and SuperDuper does this as well. She sent a link to a description of SuperDuper handling iPhoto correctly, too, but I went to the horse's mouth, shirt-pocket.com, and I checked in the forums, and sure enough, it completely understands package files and treats them as the separate bits they actually are. So I'm back to wondering why my super-duper backups take so long. Bart says it's because I have a couple of billion files, but I still don't buy that. Now that opens the question, though. What about Mosey? I searched online for information on how Mosey attacks this problem, and I came up empty. So I went to the Mosey support site, and I went into live chat. Demodar got online with me, and at first they didn't understand my question. I was certain I hadn't gotten the package file part of it across, so I went through it again, and this person wandered off to check resources, and then came back and assured me that Mosey does not upload the entire package file every time you edit one photo. Something still left me questioning, so I asked for a link to the support document so I could reference it in the show notes, and they sent me to a link. But I followed it, and instead of directly taking me to the article, it was the full documentation of Mosey's application and how it works on the Mac. I did a search on iPhoto in there, and it found nothing. I searched on packages, and I found nothing related there, too. So I'm not 100% certain either way about how Mosey handles package files, but this person did seem fairly confident after checking with some other resources. If any of you out there can find a documented answer to this from a reliable source, though, I'd be glad to know, and so would John. It doesn't explain why it keeps trying to upload another extra, I don't know what it was, 40 gigabytes for him, though. A couple of weeks ago, Bart was explaining to me how to set the file permissions in WordPress, and he talked about setting them to 755 in Unix, and he mentioned words like read, write, and execute. Now, Bart has explained this to me in detail several times, and on a good day, I could maybe pull off kind of a high-level explanation, but I could not give the level of detail necessary to actually help anyone with this. Jim Sewell wrote in with some fabulous instructions that explain exactly what all these numbers mean and the logic behind them. Now, I gotta tell you, reading these out loud would be dreadfully boring. I'd say pretty much like reading the phone book. So I put his explanation in the show notes instead so you can read it for yourself, and better yet, I can refer back to it later. That is one of the coolest parts about having this blog that I write everything down in. I don't have to remember anything because I can just go back to the show notes and read what I wrote. I liked how he started the email. Jim said, the title was NoSilicast/Bart the Big Brain. I liked it. Anyway, head on over to the show notes and learn all about read, write, execute privileges and how that numbering scheme works. Now, Jim has been on fire for the past couple of weeks. He also sent in an audio file giving some great advice on doing operating system upgrades that applies to more than just the Mac. Let's hear Jim's advice.
Hi, Allison. This is Jim from Key West. I have a tip for your listeners who have not yet upgraded to Snow Leopard that you might call the dumb tip to go along with dumb questions. You'll see why in a moment. First things first. If you're going to upgrade your operating system, make absolutely positively sure you have a good backup. Boot from it by holding the Option key when you turn your computer on. It will ask which device to boot from, and if you select your backup drive and everything boots and looks right, then you can rest easier that you have a valid bootable backup. I was one of the Friday night upgraders. I just switched to Mac from Windows last year and couldn't wait to see how awesome the Mac OS upgrade experience would be. I wasn't disappointed. Very easy, relatively fast, 45 minutes for me, and I felt totally comfortable with it. Well, except when it rebooted part of the way through. But when it came back up and it was still upgrading, I just realized it does that. No worries, though. I have my Leopard backup just in case. I must say, everything I use works, And for that, I'm very thankful and happy, but I realize that might not be totally typical. So here it is on Wednesday. I come home after a long day of work and my work at the church, and I fall right back into my old habits. I look at all my mounted drives, I look at Super Duper, and I thought, gosh, it's been days since I did a backup. As soon as I clicked on the copy button, I had one of those Homer Simpson dope moments. I knew immediately that my safe, solid Leopard backup was gone forever, being backed up on top of as I winced in pain. Okay, this is supposed to be a tip, not just how dumb I can be. The tip I have for everyone is that when you get a good backup and boot from it and everything works, turn off your Mac and unplug the drive. Save it until you're ready to wipe it out on purpose. With it unplugged, you'll have to think about it before you can accidentally wipe it out. I'm glad Snow Leopard is doing well for me, but boy, do I feel dumb. Thanks for the great show, Allison.
Well, Jim, I certainly empathize with you on that. I've been holding off running a Super Duper backup at home until I'm double secret sure I have everything I need off that backup drive. This is especially important if you do a nuke and pave clean install like I did. Just this week, I realized that I had some mail saved on my Mac, not an IMAP, and I had forgotten to pull it over. I dragged it back over, so I'm really glad I didn't overwrite it. I've been toying with two ideas, though. One is, maybe I'll just buy another terabyte drive for $100 and throw it in my IC dock enclosure and put that Leopard backup disk on the shelf. That would be really, really fail-safe. Another option I'm wondering whether it would work would be, take my backup on that external drive and put it in a folder and then start a new backup from scratch on the same drive. I think this might work because I've got a 300 gigabyte drive with only 220 gig filled up on my laptop, so I could literally get like four full backups on that terabyte external. I haven't gotten my nerve up to try it yet. I'm not sure how Super Duper would handle it. I would hope it wouldn't overwrite all the other stuff on the drive. I did also make a folder on the external drive called Random Backups, and I've been dragging files over there one by one. You know, like right after I record Chit Chat Across the Pond, I throw it over on that external drive before the show is produced, so I'm sure I've got that covered for the time being. Got a copy of the show notes partway through the week, too, so I'm sure I've got a backup partway through. I did go ahead and overwrite my offsite backup drive with a Snow Leopard full Super Duper backup, so I've got that coverage, too. Anyway, thanks for the great tip, Jim. I bet you helped somebody out. Well, it's back to school time, and I thought this might be a good time to remind you of a great podcast for anyone you know who's taking AP European History this year. Or maybe you just like history in general. You might like this too. Hank's History Hour at hankshistoryhour.com was created by Hank Nelson, who was a senior in high school when he started this. He's a nutball about AP European history. He got a grade of 115% in the class, which was the highest ever recorded at his high school in all time. I don't know how, I think the school's like 100 years old. There probably was an AP Euro back then. But anyway, you get my point. He's the kind of guy that was always bothering his friends and family members. I mean, I remember we were driving to Disneyland one time and he's telling his friends all about Napoleon. You know, they were captive audience and he was driving them nuts. Well, I suggested to him that instead of bothering people about it, he should do a podcast to people who care. And that was the genesis of Hank's History Hour. The podcast takes you through the predefined curriculum that every student in the United States has to take for that class to prepare for the AP exam. Hank tells it like a story, though, going from chapter to chapter through the book while entertaining you with his own enthusiasm for this subject. He just loves it. What's unusual about Hank's History Hour as a podcast is that it repeats every year for the next class. He doesn't have to create new content. It just starts over with a new group of listeners. If you go to the site, you can read the comments of kids thanking him for making history a joy to learn and helping them pass the AP exams. There's all these testimonials of kids going, "Oh, dude, you saved my life. This was fantastic." Pass this along to anyone you know who's in the class or maybe who has kids that age that are about to take the class. It's a fantastic podcast. Again, it's at hankshistoryhour.com. Well, I did promise this was a marathon show. One of the things I've been holding over for quite a while is an interview with my buddy Ron about, well, you'll see. I'll give you the setup when we start into this segment. Okay, I'm going to do an experiment here. I have waylaid my friend Ron because I have a question I want to ask him. And usually what happens is I ask him these questions and we have these brilliant, witty, insightful conversations. And I go, dang, we should have recorded that. So I've plied him with a glass of wine and we're going to see if we can have some fun here. So, Ron, first say hi to the NoSillaCast crowd.
Hi.
All right.
Was that stilted enough?
Yes, that was stilted enough. Okay, so what I was thinking about, I was just jawing around in my head, and I was thinking about Twitter, and then I was thinking about more. What is the ham radio Morse code stuff that you've done over the years? Mm-hmm. Isn't it sort of the same thing? You're having little bitty conversations with people all over the world, and it's really exciting that you get to know people that you don't, you know, you may have never met.
There probably is some similarity. I hadn't thought about it, but because amateur radio is a RF thing, so you're in the ether.
Right.
If you have someone out there, they are broadcasting. They're an amateur radio station. And so if you think about it, if you have someone who is really notable and, you know, people will listen if they hear them on the dial.
Oh.
Then.
So it's more about broadcasting? It's not a conversation? I thought it was more of a conversation.
No, it is a conversation, but normally it would be a few people on a frequency. Otherwise, it gets to be a little bit difficult because it's like if you're in a room full of people trying to have the same conversation.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you stay on one frequency as a few people, another frequency as a few other people?
Correct.
But you can spin that dial and change who you're talking to?
Right. So it's kind of like a radio dial, if you will. It's just that these are individual people, but you can put as many people on a frequency as can converse.
Can understand. But so when you do the ham radio stuff, or I don't know if you still do it, but you talk to people like in Guam and all kinds of crazy places, right?
Given
that's part of the thing,
right? Given the right propagation, there is a whole kind of subgenre of amateur radio called DXing.
Okay,
DX is a radio term. It's an abbreviation in Morse code, actually, for distance or long distance.
Okay.
And so people who are DXers, their whole reason for living, basically, is to talk to people long ways away across the globe. And they'll try to get as many countries as possible, talk to as many people in different countries, that kind of thing. So I've talked with people in about 235 different countries around the world.
Wow. Now, when you're talking to them, do you have interesting conversations, or is it simply, whoa, I got Guam today, that was amazing? Not, I talked to Bob, and I found out his wife is sick.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's another subcategory that kind of overlaps with DXing, and that's rag chewing. Okay, and rag chewers are the guys who literally get up in the morning, they fire up the rig, they get on the air, and they talk to either people they don't know, or occasionally they have schedules with people they do know. But the whole idea is you could sit there for 6 hours with this guy and just talk an ear off.
And have a good time.
Huh? Have a good time.
You know what? It's okay, so the Twitter analogy is Michael King. Michael King is, he tells us when he gets up in the morning, he tells us when he goes to bed at night, and he's on Uvu when he's not in Ustream, or you know, he's moving around, but he's always on Twitter, and you know where he's going, anytime you want someone to talk to, you know Michael King's there.
That's right, and there actually have been kind of pseudo-celebrities in amateur radio, people who, for whatever reason, became well-known, and so, and often these guys would be on a particular frequency at a particular time of day. And so, you know, there used to be this crazy guy down in Belize, and his call sign was V31BB, and this guy was just funny to listen to, and whoever he was talking to, it didn't really matter, and I even talked with him a couple of times, but, you know, you tune in, you say, where is that guy, you know?
Huh. So, does my Twitter analogy hold up at all? What parts of it are like Twitter?
Well, I think it's like Twitter in the sense that it is a broadcast medium, in the sense that, you know, if you hear somebody and it's someone you recognize, somebody that, like I say, may be well known, just maybe to you and your friends, but mm-hmm. someone you know, you may tune in while he's talking to somebody else and you may join the conversation, or you may just sit back and kind of listen and see, you know, what's the guy up to, right?
So that's like watching the Twitter stream that's following a guy in Twitter.
Exactly.
And then when you join in the conversation with them, that's maybe like an at reply, but you're actually talking to people. This is...
Right. You're actually talking, unless, like you said, with Morse code, the CW.
Yeah, that's where I was thinking of the Morse code side. That's different than amateur radio.
No, it's...
Oh, it is.
It's part of amateur radio. It's a different mode instead of voice.
Okay.
Now, that actually has... a similarity in the sense of what you were saying, which is very few characters.
Right.
Right. And so you have a lot of abbreviations. Because
you can't push that little button that long, right? I mean, you could do an essay, but who would, right?
Right. There tend to be people, there's a smaller fraction of people who are very accomplished. There are people that literally it's a skill or a art or something where mm-hmm. they can listen to something that to you or me sounds like a bumblebee buzzing, and that's 50 or 60 words a minute.
Oh, jeez.
In order to get my amateur radio license, the highest I ever had to be able to show competency was 20 words a minute, mm-hmm. which for me is just on the edge.
That's on the edge. That was
sanity.
A struggle, huh? Oh, interesting.
But the point is, in most conversations, you're right, that you have very short conversation. You tell them things like your location, your name, what the weather's like, what kind of radio you're using. And then the other guy will come back and tell you the same kind of thing.
And then would you drop it or would you try to find that guy again?
Well, it depends. Sometimes people just click. It's just like, you know, you meet somebody with similar...
Just like Twitter.
Right. So there used to be a guy that I ran into out in Perth, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on at a certain time, and the propagation certain time of the year was just right. And you could mm-hmm. usually hear the guy when he was on. He was retired, so he was on a lot. And he was a delightful guy to talk to. He talked to you about his cat and everything else. And I asked him a lot about Australia. So I kind of got to know the guy. And
now, was that Morse code or was that in...
That was actually voice. Although uh-huh. he also used code. And I actually talked to him on Morse as well.
You should check and see if he's on Twitter.
He may be.
I mean, he might have moved there, right?
It's interesting, too, because amateur radio has actually suffered to some extent with a lot of people that normally would have entered amateur radio now with the internet.
Mm.
That the substitute is things like Twitter or Facebook and
right.
so forth instead of going to amateur radio because now you can talk around the world through the internet.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to go on too long on this, but I did part of what triggered this was an article in Wired, and I know you're always two issues ahead of me because I'm two issues behind today's date. But it was talking about how Marconi figured out that you could actually bounce radio off of the ozone or the ionosphere.
Yes.
And is that when you're talking about like being able to get to Belize or to Perth, it's because of the bouncing off the ionosphere was just right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. What, in fact,
a practical application of what I learned.
It is. No, that's exactly what it is. There's something called there are different layers of the ionosphere, and there's in particular one called, I think it's the F2 layer. And that is the most mirror-like, and the height of it varies with season and with solar activity.
And they said with time of day, they said
yes.
certain layers disappear at night.
Correct. And so what happens is sometimes the lower layers act as absorption.
Okay.
And so you get less signal through, and it shortens the distance you can talk.
Okay.
And then often at night, these layers will disappear.
And then you get the mirror on the other
ones? And sometimes you get multiple bounces to get to a place like Perth.
Really? So it's hitting the ionosphere and bouncing off what? The Earth?
Bouncing back off the Earth. Or
another layer
or
that
another
got
layer.
Reflective in
that,
the other
no, that's
direction?
Correct.
Oh,
or another
wow.
layer in the ionosphere.
And that's so true, because if it's night here, it's day there, you could end up with a day layer that's not letting
correct.
Anything through and you're bouncing off the inside channel or
and,
something?
Yes, and,
wow.
And actually that's a really important point because the way that you can often estimate what the conditions will be at each end, like can I talk to X, you know, mm-hmm. Kenya, part of that is very heavily dependent on what the time of day is at both locations.
Oh, wow.
And often the best time is when both locations are at the dividing point where it's sunset and twilight. At each end.
You're
right near the demarcation point.
Interesting. So. Well, so I can picture thinking like when you look at a Twitter and a Facebook, it's like, you know, in my day we walked 17 miles in the snow. You know, I mean, there's a certain pride in having succeeded at that where today it's not near the challenge that it was.
It's true. And in fact, nowadays, the biggest thing that happened in amateur radio a couple years ago is that they no longer have a requirement for code.
Oh, come on. Back when men were men, you know, and you had to follow the code. That's kind of weak. I bet there was a big...
it's not exactly a code. It's more like a guideline.
And on that note, I think we'll call that quits. Thanks a lot, Ron. And how can people follow you on Twitter?
Oh, I'm Phase Noise, all one word. PHASENOISE.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ron.
Thank you.
Dumb questions.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, it's time for that part of the show where listeners submit questions they think are too dumb to ask, but of course are not dumb at all. Here you can ask without any fear of mockery for a question that's too easy. You might get mocked for giving me one that's too hard, but not for too easy. Sean Peterson sent in his dumb question this week. I really have a good dumb question this time.
Following the announcement of the new iPod line, I had some thinking to do about what model and size would make the most sense. However, one problem occurred to me. When I go to my library in iTunes, I don't know of an option to see how much space is taken by the library as a whole, just categories of music, video, etc. I know I can access the library in Finder, but I now see that there are multiple files, including Genius, Extras, and iTunes 9, and not to mention my audiobooks from Audible or any of my MP3 folders from Amazon. Aside from hooking up an iPod, syncing everything, and looking at the color bar for data use, is there another way to find out how much space is taken up by iTunes, including third-party media like Audible and Amazon? Thanks so much. Love the show more and more and miss the podcasting and podcasting show. I learned a lot there. Well, Sean, this is a great question. I had to poke around a bit to figure this one out, but it turns out there's a really easy way to figure it out. It turns out that smart and dumb playlists tell you how big they are. So all you have to do is create a smart playlist that has parameters that all of your content meets. In my digging, I found someone recommending that you set the parameter to be date added is after, and you give a date so far back in the past that it's sure to be everything. I set mine back to, everything dated after 1958, the year I was born. And now when I click on the smart playlist at the bottom, it tells me my iTunes library is 14.17 gigabytes in size. I verified that this smart playlist includes music, audio podcasts, and video podcasts, and even the PDF casts in the Nightwise podcast that he uses to create creates to document how to do things in Ubuntu. So I'm pretty darn sure this method will get you everything in your iTunes library.
Dumb question. What exactly does one do at Macworld?
Well, Rose, that's a good question. What does one do at Macworld? This is a question you can ask. If you ask enough people, you're going to get 126 different answers. Heck, you could ask Victor Cahiao of the Typical Mac User podcast, and he's going to tell you, you can get up at 4 a.m. and go on a photo walk and get the most incredible photos. You may think I'm kidding, but along with all the hard work and discovery Victor does at the show, he also really enjoys his yearly sojourn into the woods at dawn. I have never made that, by the way. I'll try to break this down for you, but don't look to me as by any means the definitive guide to Macworld Expo, but I'll give you my view of the show. The show starts on Tuesday, February 9th and runs through Saturday, February 13th. You've got your classes, which are pretty much high-end with a few lower-end options, but mostly high-end. These are big-time commitments to provide professional training from fantastic instructors at a price you'd expect for this kind of quality. I have to admit that I've never attended any of the classes myself, but the folks I've talked to who do attend enjoy them immensely. The exhibit halls are where the excitement is for me. Imagine booths as far as the eye can see filled with yummy Mac products. No booth you go into will say, "Oh, you know, we're thinking about porting a Mac version someday." It's all about our toys and our fun. You can touch the hardware products and play with them. You can demo the software applications live. And most importantly, you can talk to the actual developers. You can ask them questions and learn about where they're going with the products. I was really delighted to meet Gita from 1Password last year and Gene McDonald from Smile on My Mac both years at their Macworld booths. It's really fun to hunt down booths for applications I really like to tell the developers in person how much I enjoy their products, or to tell them about a great idea I have for their tool. I'm sure they appreciate me helping them that way, don't you think? For example, I had trouble a few years ago with a device from Buffalo. So I hunted down their booth, talked to one of the guys there, and he later got me in touch with someone who solved the problem I'd been struggling with for months. Of course, the best part about Macworld Expo, I mean the main reason you go, is the iPhone cases. Just about every third booth is an iPhone case booth. Hundreds of booths, maybe thousands of booths with iPhone cases. Well, even with an expo floor, with just the expo floor pass, which I think you can find free ones from here and there if you dig around, there are a few key events you can attend just with that. The keynote in 2010 will be David Pogue, for example. You may remember that I broke this story. After he did a speech, I went up to him to congratulate him, and I told him, "I think you should be the keynote speaker in 2010." And he said, "I am." "Oh, wait, that's not public knowledge yet." And I said, "It is now," as I walked off stage tweeting it. Anyway, there are other speeches by Mac notables that you'll enjoy, too. A true highlight of the expo last year was the Mac Roundtable live event. Well, at least it was a highlight for me. Come meet your favorite Mac podcasters in real life. I mean, seriously, what could be better than that?
And then there's the parties. Now, I'm not like normal people. The kind of parties I like are the ones where there's a few, maybe some free hors d'oeuvres, possibly a free drink or two or even paid for. And a lot of people show up because there's free food. You have some light music in the background just to keep things lively, but acoustic so you can talk to people and get to know them. Normal people seem to like the parties where music is really, really loud and you can't talk to anyone. I went to one of those last year and everybody else came back, wow, that was fantastic. And I was just like, I didn't meet anybody, didn't talk to anybody, couldn't have any fun. I guess since I don't like music, that might have been a contributing factor. In any case, you can find both kinds of parties at Macworld Expo if you hunt around. So if you haven't booked your trip to Macworld yet, be sure you do. I know Rose already has, so go just to meet her. She's flying all the way in from Australia to go to it. Later in the show, you're going to hear Nightwise talking about how he uses screen steps to create his technical tutorials for his podcast. Our discussion centers around things you can do to unleash yourself from dependency on one operating system. One of the ways you can do that is by using cross-platform software like ScreenSteps. It doesn't yet run on Linux. I got to ask him about that. But it does run on Windows and the Mac, which is great. They've done a fantastic job of making it exactly identical on both, so you can slide seamlessly back and forth without having to remember different buttons or menu choices. If you're like Nightwise and I, and you find yourself teaching simple things to other people on the computer, or maybe even complex tasks, or possibly creating advanced manuals for your software applications, you really should check out ScreenSteps at ScreenSteps.com. For $40 for a standard version, or $80 for the pro version, you really can't buy more happiness for the dollar, in my opinion. You'll find yourself wanting to document things for people. Heck, you can even knock that price down by 25% by entering the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, when you go to buy it. What are you waiting for? Well, Frank Moda sent in a clarification on something Bart and I were discussing a few weeks back. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
Hi, Allison. This is Frank from Boston. I was just wanting to comment on your last episode where you and Bart talked about the way Snow Leopard now counts megabytes and gigabytes. The reason I think Apple Swish is most likely due to a change in the standards that occurred several years ago. In December 1998, the IEC, or the International Electrotechnical Commission, created a standard defining the binary prefixes mebi, gibi, tebi, and so on, so as to remove the ambiguity between what mega, giga, tera actually mean. Since then, the standard has also been approved by the IEEE, the International Committee for Weights and Measures, and the International Standards Organization. The only group that has rejected the change is the International Bureau of Weights and Measures. This group maintains the International Standard of Units, also known as SI units, and they don't include computing units within their standard. I have included links to a few documents within my email to you. So, I do not believe Apple is just changing so as to avoid confusion with hard drive manufacturers. Apple is really just the first operating system to conform to a standard that has been in place for 11 years. All the other OSs are technically incorrect. The way I see it, Apple had two ways to conform to the standard. They could have changed all their units to KIB, MIB, GIB, and TIB, but this would confuse users as most people would never have heard of these unit abbreviations, and it wouldn't solve the confusion between the storage listed on the hard drive and the storage listed within the OS. The other choice was to change the way the OS calculates. This allows Apple to conform to the standard, keep the KB, MB, GB, and TB abbreviations, and resolve the confusion between the hardware and software measurements. It makes sense to me that Apple chose the latter as it killed two birds with one stone, with what would be a relatively easy fix to make. I hope this information helps you. I really love the show. Keep up the good work.
Well, Frank, for a discussion of IEEE specifications, this was really interesting. I'm glad to hear it's not a dopey thing Apple did just on its own, and I'm fascinated that it's taking so long for people to adopt this new terminology. I had no idea it was decided that long ago by the standards committees. For those listening and for whom reading IEEE specs is a particular fascination, Frank included some resources in the show notes for further perusal. Thanks so much, Frank, for bringing us that recording. Well, as promised a couple times in the show here, next up we have an interview with Nightwise, also known as one of the Spare Belgians. He's going to talk to us about how to release yourself from being dependent on one operating system or one proprietary program. Well, I'm really excited to have a return guest on the show. We have Nightwise again from the ever-famous Nightcast, hosted over at nightwise.com. How are you doing today?
I feel like I'm on dial-up. I really do. I have... today I am using African internets, I think.
Where's that pigeon when you need him, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I could strap an SD card to a pigeon and ship it over. It would be faster that way.
So we've been watching different things here on the Skype connection, trying to get started for about a half hour here. One of the things that changes whether you have a good Skype telephone conversation is your round trip time. And normally, like say between Bart and I in Ireland, it's maybe 200 milliseconds. We are varying between 200 milliseconds that we're at this exact instant to up to 2 full seconds. So if you hear us kind of stomp all over each other, that would explain why.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrible. I'm sitting right across from my router. I've never had this before. I upgraded my laptop to Snow Leopard today, upgraded my Skype to the latest version today. And for the first time, I'm having all these problems. I'm not saying those issues are related, because this is clearly a connection problem. But this is the first time that Belgian Broadband's letting me down.
Aw. Well, let's go ahead and kick in. I wanted to talk to Nightwise because he did a show recently called Kilroy 2.0. Why don't you give him a setup for what it was you were talking about?
Those of you who might have been reading J.C. Hutchins' Seven Son might recognize the name Kilroy 2.0. He's the mad hacker. And I was taking the name of the character from the book as the title for my podcast. Kilroy 2.0 basically deals with the fact that as a true geek, as a true citizen of cyberspace, you have to be everywhere. And that means that you can be... that you have to be operating system independent. Doesn't matter what operating system you're using, doesn't matter what application you're using, doesn't matter what computer you're using, what hardware, what connection. It's a show that teaches you how to become completely independent of those factors of applications, certain operating systems, certain types of hardware, certain types of connection, and just transcend all that and basically become Kilroy 2.0, who is everywhere, no matter what he is using.
Yeah, I thought this was a really intriguing topic. I wanted to add to some stuff you said, maybe argue with you a little bit if I can. And I essentially understand what you're saying, and I agree that it's pretty cool if you can be platform independent. One of the things that you talked about was how people say, I need Word on my machine, and you say, do you mean you need a word processor? And they're like, no, I mean Word. And they think they have to have Word, but 98.7% of us actually use it to type and, maybe put a bullet in once in a while. So it's not really essential. And you talked about using things like OpenOffice. But I'd like to take you a step further. Why use an Office documentation product at all? Why not just use a wiki? I use wikis for everything now, so I don't have any documents on my hard drive. The only time I have a document is if I print my wiki stuff to a PDF, just so I'm sure I've got an extra copy of it.
True. I mean, one of the other alternatives that I've mentioned is not only using OpenOffice as a cross-platform application that makes you operating system independent, but also going towards Google Reader. Google Docs. Going towards Google Docs and pushing your cloud, word processing to the cloud, but actually, as you said, a wiki is going one step further because it also makes you Google independent, and that is that's also a value these days. And that's one of the reasons I haven't used that in the example is because I don't have a lot of personal experience with wikis. But it is indeed true. It is a much more advanced way of working. Reasons I put Word out there as an example is because we all encounter it, and because it's this classic. This is my computer. This is my Word. These are my Word documents on my hard drive. And I just wanted to point out that basically all of these my things are obsolete because it is, as you say, you can put it in a word processor. You can put them on a location, not in on that specific location. You can put them in the cloud, on the network, wherever you want to go. And wikis are certainly one step beyond that. What I said as an example for web authoring software, where it used to be My Dreamweaver or, God forbid, My Front Page, we now go towards things like WordPress and Joomla. So you're absolutely right there, and I am to blame because I don't have a lot of experience with wikis, because I'm still posting the challenge out there for somebody to officially set up a Wikipedia page for me, so I can log on to an open Wi-Fi and edit some comments to say that I'm just downright awesome and get away with it.
Yeah, apparently, even if somebody does put it up for you, if you're not considered worthy of being famous enough, it'll get taken down by the wiki police. So even if they did it for you, it might come back down.
I know you. That makes me famous enough. I'm one of the three Belgians.
That's right. My Belgian staff. Actually, Steve and I were talking about...
We're like national icons.
Steve and I were talking about that in the car today. He pointed out that there are actually more European and Australian contributors to the NoSilicast than there are domestic, U.S. domestic contributors. And I said, yeah, if you look at my stats, I should see Belgium as like 30% of my listeners.
Yeah, I at least 30% of your contributors. But I don't know, but Bart doesn't really count. You know, Belgians are cool. They're smart. They're good looking.
And you say Bart isn't?
No. Well, he doesn't really meet up to all these standards, so we ship him to Ireland.
Wait, he's not cool. He's not good looking. He's not smart. Did you really just say that?
Sure he is. I'm just teasing.
Oh, you're just sad because he left and moved to Ireland.
Yeah. We had to send him abroad because he was the coolest kid in town and nobody else would stand a chance. We couldn't hold a candle to him, so we had to ship him abroad. It was the only thing we could do.
Oh, there we go. Well, back on topic. One thing maybe we should do at some point is try to do a comparison of Google Docs to writing in a wiki, because I don't actually use Google Docs and you don't use a wiki very much. I've dabbled in Google Docs. I'm afraid I shunned it immediately because I tested out the Excel equivalent, the spreadsheet program. And the first thing I did, I was able to get it to fail, mathematically fail. Like I typed a 2 in a cell and I typed a 3 below it and I did a sum up instead of summing down and it got the wrong answer.
Oh, yeah, but you like code DNA in Excel. I mean, you're so really good at it. For me, it's just like putting numbers alongside each other and perhaps I've seen people who use a calculator and add the Excel cells just manually, you know, by typing all the values into a calculator. I'm probably one of those people when it comes down to Excel.
I guess that gets back to one of the questions I wanted. Yeah, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, you speak as though you slide seamlessly between all these different OSs or different tools and stay independent, but you must still have a preference. Like when I'm on this OS, I'm happier. When I'm in this tool that is platform dependent, I'm actually happier. Or you won't confess it.
Yeah, I do. I will. I'm a slider. A lot of people make their choice of OS a political one. They go like, I use this and there.
Or religious.
And I'm not like that. An OS is a tool. It's almost religious. And to me, an OS is a tool. If I want to, my main OS, basically, if I take a look at the hours a day that I sit behind the computer, most of the time I work on Windows for work. But even when I'm there, I've got an SSH where I run Linux applications, so I kind of use them side by side. Mm-hmm. When I get home, I'm mostly on my Mac. All the creative stuff, must say, podcast production and stuff like that, I do it on my Mac. I absolutely do it here because it's the most stable and convenient platform to do it in. When I want raw power, when I want to script things, download things, extract like 50 RAR files or God knows what and stuff like that, I go towards Linux because that's its strength. And when I want compatibility with just about everything, I can pop over to the Windows side. At home, I hardly or never use a Windows system. I'm mostly on OS X with a VM of Ubuntu running in the back. But I don't jump from graphical interface to graphical interface. I mostly have OS X running and a terminal connection, a command line connection to that Ubuntu VM up top. So just like I'm using both of them at the same time, sometimes I even have my OS X screen on one virtual desktop using Spaces, and I've got Ubuntu on the second one, and I've got applications open in Ubuntu, and I've got applications open in OS X, and I just jump in between them using the cloud as the place where I store everything.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Have you ever used a tool called, it'd be much better if I get it, I think it's called Synergy, that allows you to have two monitors with one keyboard and mouse, and you can have two different operating systems on the two monitors. So you've got two CPUs talking to the two monitors, but you can actually slide back and forth between the two with the mouse, and you can actually copy and paste between the two operating systems.
I've got a video of that. It's one of the first KWTV episodes where I show my home setup, which is basically my 24-inch iMac in the middle, a 19-inch screen hooked up as a secondary screen, and a second 19-inch screen on the other side with my MacBook Pro underneath it. And using Synergy, I have one virtual machine open on the secondary screen of the iMac running Linux. I've got the iMac running OS X in the middle. I've got my MacBook Pro running also OS X. I can slide over there using Synergy. And the second screen of my MacBook Pro is running Windows. So I've got four operating systems on four screens, and I can control them with one keyboard and one mouse. There's a nice video of how I've set a stop of how I built it.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to mention about KWTV is that you distribute the information in the best format for the particular thing you're trying to teach. So Nightwise does he does audio recordings frequently from his car, which are amazingly coherent. I really don't understand how you can just simply speak fluidly like that all by yourself with no script for up to an hour, and it's fascinating, and you don't seem to ramble or anything. But then sometimes you'll get videos where you get video screencasts, and you can see exactly what he's doing, and it's kind of fun to see him outside playing, frolicking in the woods and that sort of thing. But then sometimes you get PDF files, which are instructional manuals that he's created, of course, using screen steps.
Yeah, I've stepped away from the audio only feed because I came up to the point where I wanted to explain certain applications, and that audio, I came to the limits of audio, and I said like, okay, I'm going to try to do video, and I didn't want to, you know, use another feed. I'm going like, yeah, I've got a video feed and an audio feed. Damn, I've got all these subscribers on this one feed. I'm going to give them everything. So I actually said enough with a podcasting feed. I'm going to call it the media feed, and you're going to get the medium that suits the topic that I'm talking about the best. Either that be a Screen Steps tutorial, for which Screen Steps is an awesome tool. I keep saying that. That's one of the reasons that one of the reasons I like Screen Steps is because I can use it both on Windows and on my Mac, and I actually miss it on Linux. I use Screen Steps. I pop the occasional audio file in there, and I pop a video file in there. Whatever suits me to explain what I want to talk about. The trick about podcasting in the car is probably I'm in the car quite a lot, and I've got the story of the podcast in my head, and sometimes I've got little bullet notes that I just have in front of me because I have to pay attention to traffic, of course, and yeah. There's just nobody to interrupt me, so I just ramble on for an hour. So,
but again, it doesn't sound like rambling. It's very, very coherent. If I were to do that, I'd just be all over the map, I think. But I think the first thing I ever heard you do was you were explaining some intricate commands in Linux where you're describing exactly how to do some long, involved process, and you're spitting out these commands. I'm thinking, how on earth did you do that? Impressive.
I don't know. I think I listen to audio a lot in the car, and I think I reproduce information the same way. Some commands I can just, you know, almost say by heart, and then I'll just I won't close my eyes, at least not in a car, but in the back of my mind, I will have my screen in front of me and go like, which command do I type now? Which button do I press now? And then just, you know, talk. I'll do a screen. I'll do a video in my head and explain the and narrate it as I'm driving, actually.
Cool. Well, I think the fact that you do the audio, the video, and the screen steps tutorials all in the same feed is actually an example of Kilroy 2.0, don't you think?
Yeah, you shouldn't. I wish I had the consistency of producing a podcast every single week. I do. I so much kudos to you. I so know that whenever the Nasilicast were to be a day late or you wouldn't be there on Monday, I'd be calling your house, see if you're all right, because I'm so used to that consistency. I just wish I had that one. But I'm somebody who also goes like, yeah, I want to do that today, and I want to try that today, and I want to try that today. And sometimes I have the time to podcast because I'm in the car and I have some inspiration. And sometimes me and Niyana are out there and we have the opportunity to shoot some videos, and I've got some ideas in my head what I want to show in the screencast, and we'll do that. And sometimes some spare time during my lunch break, and I'll try to draw up a screen steps tutorial. It's actually kind of what my agenda allows and what my inspiration comes up with, I'll do, because it's not always that easy to find a topic to talk about for a whole hour. And sometimes the topics are innovative, but I don't lead a life that is so incredibly exciting that I have to basically innovate and reinvent the technological wheel every week. So this week's example, the KC0026, is going to be a little bit of everything. Me just talking off the cuff a little bit. There's a sound seeing tour in there of me refueling the car. We talk Windows. We talk about consulting. Stuff like that, whatever comes to mind.
Well, I think that is one of the things that I really like about your show is that it actually takes a little bit of pressure off that you're not coming out with weekly episodes where I feel like I'm getting too far behind. I can go in and just have a little sip of Nightwise from now and again, and I look through and I say, oh, what's interesting? Oh, he's got a thing on netbooks. I think I'll listen to that. Oh, here, he's configuring Ubuntu server. I think I'll skip that one. You know, I jump around and I'll just go in and read a screen steps tutorial, or I'll listen to an audio show, or once in a while I just want to see your ugly mug and I put the video up, that kind of thing. So
yeah, but that's basically what it's all about. I wanted to set up the show in a way of that every episode is an individual part that you can use whenever you need to. If you want to, that's a topic that interests me, I'll skip back three shows, and that's something I like, I'll skip ahead. I try to make them individual stories, individual topics, and I don't do a lot of feedback. I don't do a lot of last week we talked about, because as for you, I enjoy your shows because they are so chronological, because they refer back and they go forth and stuff like that. But I try to isolate every single show so people can really pick and choose what interests them, because the topics are so diverse.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that's fun about podcasting is there aren't really any rules. I kind of set a rule for myself to be consistent, because I knew that if I didn't go on a schedule, I would go months without doing anything. So I kind of need deadlines in order to actually function to do a good job. Maybe that's part of my anal retentive engineering background, but there aren't any rules. You can do it often. You can do it frequently. You can do it on an exact basis like I do. There's no rules. It can be long. It can be short. I love it when people ask me, how long is a podcast? My father used to always answer that question with, how big is a lump of coal? Which I didn't completely understand.
You have Taco Bell Thursday. Of course you're consistent.
You bet. All right. Well, Nightwise, why don't you spell for them, tell them every different way, your Twitter, your feeds, your website. What do we got?
I've got consistency there. It's www.nightwise.com. That's KNIGHTWISE.com. Twitter is also Nightwise. Skype is also Nightwise. Email is nightwise@nightwise.com. So if you get to spell it right once, you can find me just about anyway, any possible medium. It's Nightwise on Facebook. Fans of Nightwise.com is a group that you can join. So kind of all over the place with a with the same tag. And unlike Wizard Gold from Mag 20 Questions said, me and my better half don't call each other Nightwise and Nyanna during the day, because he heard that from some nondescriptive person. And he asked me that in the last episode of Mac 20Q.
You actually said you do. Yeah, and I'll go back and play the recording again. But the last time we talked, you said sometimes we just call each other by our internet names when we're at home. So that's probably where you heard
we
it.
We do. Darn! it's strange when we activate the iRiver to do a recording together, or we activate the camera to do a KW TV screencast, and the lingo of the house goes to English. Joe and Saskia go away, and Nightwise and Nyanna are names that are really true to us. But most of the time, not all of the time, we speak. Mostly Dutch in the house, but not all the time, because it's getting more and more towards our Anglo-Saxon influences. They're really taking over, and we are surprising people from time to time by yapping back and forth in English while we're in company of other Flemish-speaking people who know we speak Flemish as well. So that's getting really weird. But that's all.
So between your internet world, your double languages, you're just completely confused now.
I think culturally we are shifting, because we are, especially with Facebook, Twitter, stuff like that, our social circle is so much centered toward the English-speaking part of the world that that's where our home culture is actually heading. It's a really weird phenomenon. We have become culturally independent, that as well.
Kilroy 2.0, you're everywhere.
yeah, we're all over the place. And we just don't have Taco Bell and Starbucks, but for the rest, we're good.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, and it was fun talking to you about this. It's more fun than when I'm just yelling at the iPod and I want to argue with you about stuff.
Oh, you can always call and argue, and one of these days I'll hope we get the Belgians together, and we can me and Bart and the other guy,
Peter,
Paul?
Peter Boots.
Was it Paul?
Peter Boots.
Boots, that sounds so cool. Peter Boots. They all have like funky names. No wonder I call myself Nightwise. I mean, like Bart Bouchots, that's like, wow. And Peter Boots, that's like, wow. And I have just a lame Flemish name, so I have to go by a pseudonym.
You're so funny. All right, well, let's ring it off here. It was really nice talking to you.
Oh, I just wanted to say one more thing.
Okay.
We Nyanna and I bought a new car yesterday, and we had to buy a Ford Fiesta because we wanted to buy a Honda or an Acura, but Honda Bob won't come out, so we're not going to buy one.
Well, that's good to know. I'll let him know that you've shunned him in this way. Now he's never going to come to Belgium.
Yeah. Okay, Honda Bob, just so you know, you won't come down. This is not Orange County. This is not the LA area. But if you don't come down, we're not going to buy a Honda.
With that, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Now, I'm not sure I have to do much of a Honda Bob commercial after Nightwise's snarky comments about how he refuses to go to Belgium to fix Nightwise's cars. Well, as Nightwise said, you can only have Honda Bob drive to your house and fix your cars while you rest easy if you drive a Honda or an Acura, and you can only get this outstanding service if you live in the LA or Orange County areas. You can contact him by the old-fashioned telephone at 562-531-2321, or you can shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. Hey, we got to get him on Twitter, don't we? That would be great. Anyway, remember, HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. What's that time of the show? Many people's favorite time of the show. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchots from bartb.ie.
Hi, Allison.
How are you?
I'm good. Just spent the whole day cleaning, so I'm a little sore. But aww. I had lots of good podcasts.
Oh, there you go. Hey, I got to tell you, you got to get some of that Mac Geek Gab for your cleaning needs. Works for me.
I didn't have any grout to clean, though, so it didn't seem appropriate.
So, you're getting a lot of fan mail. We get mail, I'd say, every week to every other week, talking about almost everybody puts in something about love chit-chat across the pond.
Oh, good. I'm glad someone likes our blathering. I know we do, but it's nice to see other people do, too.
Well, actually, that's one of the things they say, is they say, you guys seem to have so much fun together, so that's why they like it. So let's kick in. It's time for Security Light.
Yeah, a different one this time, in the sense that we're not talking about any particular viruses that have hit the ground or anything, or any particular malware bits and bobs, but an interesting sort of example of an ongoing problem. The New York Times were a high-profile victim of the fact that internet ads are pretty much unvetted. It's sort of a race to the bottom. People want to get as many ads for as much money as possible, and they don't really care all that much where they come from, as long as there's money past changing hands. So the lowest of the low, who wish to peddle all sorts of snake oil and all sorts of general rubbish, they all get their ads up, and then big sites like the New York Times simply go to an advertising agency and say, okay, we just want some money, so you put some ads in this little space here. And it bit them on the backside this week when they ended up advertising malware.
Yeah, ugh. And you can imagine, I mean, the newspapers are so beleaguered now with low revenues and all these problems, they'd be going, oh, somebody is going to buy an ad, yay!
Yeah, but the thing is, they're not actually managing their own ads. They're just paying an agency to do it for them, which means they don't actually care, which is stupid.
But who should have caught that?
Well, the problem is, if you do ads, rather than putting any effort into getting real ads that people may actually care about, and you simply just get like some sort of the cheapest possible agency to do it, then you're going to get the cheapest possible ads, which are at best for dodgy services and at worst malware.
Eesh. So, anything we can do about it?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is that any site that has ads, you should be careful of, and you shouldn't trust it. Which is a terrible thing to say, because ads are everywhere. But it's also a reason you won't ever see ads on my site, because I just don't hold with that kind of thing. Again, you're somewhat different, because you actually take the time to find real sponsors.
Ah.
So you've done the legwork there. You haven't gone to some agency and say, here's a hole in my website, now give me cash.
Yeah. I've also
real advertising.
Right. Sorry. I've also not participated in any of these things where it's real tempting. There are groups within the podcast community where they pull together and they do an ad and everybody jumps in and works on it together and they share the revenue. But I also like to advertise for somebody I actually believe in, not just some random thing. Maybe if I was in it for the money, it would be different.
Yeah, I suppose that's the way it is. But, you know, everyone wants everything to be free, and, well, you can't do anything for nothing, so that forces people into this ad model, because if I charge for something, no one will come. So we're sort of the tyranny of free, it must be free, it must be free. Well, then you end up with all this kind of rubbish, and it puts us all at risk.
Right, right.
So a controversial solution, and this is going to make people angry, is to use Adblock.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That doesn't actually block real genuine ads like what you would go to the bother of doing, because they're not coming from one of the advertising agencies. So Adblock has no idea that it's just a JPEG unless it comes from one of the known agencies.
Oh, okay. All right, then use Adblock, because it won't block my ads.
Well, no, but it won't block your ads or other similar ads from people who have actually gone to the bother of choosing something to advertise that they can stand over and that they believe in and they're genuinely recommending, rather than people who just for no effort whatsoever on their part take a little hole of their website and hand it over to, you know, the very margins of society.
Yeah. The other thing is, my ads are, I take a screenshot and it's always a JPEG, and I do add a link to it, and then it takes you to a site. That's all it is.
Yeah, so that is there's no way for Adblock to know that that's an ad. It's simply a JPEG and a link. Whereas if you join an ad network, you basically have an iframe or some other way of sucking content from someone else. And all Adblock does is simply stop the something else from getting in.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Now, this is obviously, the downside is that this deprives website owners of revenue. But as far as I'm concerned, if you don't take the time to actually vet your advertisements and you put me at risk, then, well, screw you, to be honest. And that's going to get me hate mail, but I stand over it.
You always do. All right, what else?
The other one, this is a bizarre one, because usually Apple are known for user friendliness and making things clear and making things simple and doing things the easiest possible way. These are all the things we love Apple for. So wait till I've explained to you how you enable anti-phishing protection on the iPod Touch. Step one, connect your iPhone or iPod Touch to Wi-Fi. Step two, plug it into iTunes. Let it finish syncing if it does that. Step three, open Safari. Step four, lock the screen. Step five, what? Walk away for an indeterminate amount of time.
Are you serious?
Yep.
So this, how often do you have to do this?
No one's really quite sure about that.
I mean, just once to turn it on, or...
Apple said, we don't want to be having, you know, unexpected network traffic occurring. So if it was updating itself over the air, well, then you might get data bills. So that's why we do it over Wi-Fi. Then we wouldn't want it to kill your battery. So that's why we only do it when it's plugged into iTunes. But the end result is, how often do you browse with Safari while plugged into iTunes over Wi-Fi?
Are you sure you don't have to throw salt over your left shoulder while you do that? I mean, that's pretty complicated.
Hop around in a circle on one leg as well. I think it has to be counterclockwise.
Ah, right. As long as you're in the northern hemisphere.
While the moon is in the fourth quarter.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's utter madness. It's snake oil stuff, but it downloads a big database of malware, which it then apparently keeps up to date with teeny tiny little additions. But you need to get that big glop onto the phone, and it does that only when you have Safari on, the screen locked, plugged into iTunes on Wi-Fi.
That's actually comedic. I mean, that's comical. Did you do it?
Yeah, it's unbelievably shockingly bad. If Microsoft did something like this, the Apple blogosphere would explode in a hail of laughter and mocking, and, you know, it'd be funny. But this is Apple. Still funny.
At some point, I need to do a diatribe on the Apple TV, because I think the same people who came up with this invented the interface to the Apple TV. But that's a whole show, I think. So,
while the Apple TV lasts,
right? Well, actually, no. I'm actually happy with it finally. But man, what a path! All right. Well, we wanted to kind of do something a little different this week. Whenever I put a new Mac up, or I start from scratch like I just did, I'm always intrigued to see what applications make the cut to go onto my Mac, and which ones are the ones that, like, this goes on first. I gotta have this. And there's probably 20 or so that if I didn't have those, I just couldn't do what I do. So Bart and I have kind of made a list here of all the different things that we use, and we sort of tried to pile them into categories. We argued for a good half hour.
Yeah. We decided not to do sort of a list of our favorites, but instead to sort of break it into tasks and to try that way pick up apps that may not be our favorite, but that we still rely on very heavily, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So why don't you start us off? Our first category is podcasting, blogging, and content creation in general.
Yeah, so making stuff.
Making stuff, right?
Best way to describe that. Despite the fact that I do a lot of podcasts, my actual podcasting gear is really rather pathetically primitive. Skype plus call recorder plus GarageBand. I'm done.
Yeah, so Skype is what we use to talk to each other, like we're using right now. Without Skype, I think we could only talk to Mac people, right? We could do this with iChat AV, a lot of what we do, but the compression algorithms aren't as good.
Yeah, it's just not as good, and... I mean, without Skype, you sort of would end up back in the old days where everyone would just talk into a mic and it'd be a one-on-one show. Sort of, you know, Mac OS X would be all there was. And no Day 6, because he talks to people then.
Yeah, well, you could talk to people, but they'd have to be on Macs.
You could on the telephone and somehow link into
Oh, that's not so good. Well, my equivalent, of course, I've got Skype, but I use Wiretap Studio to capture the audio. And I actually didn't put the entire list in here. If we want to talk about everything I use for the podcast, it just goes on and on. But so he uses Call Recorder and I use Wiretap Studio. And the important thing we started doing was he always makes a backup recording. In fact, our template for our show notes starts in bright red saying, Bart, remember to start recording.
This is from experience. I think it only happened to us once that we had to redo a show because I didn't do a backup and yours died or something.
Or I didn't have your half of the show, I think it was. I hadn't noticed that I wasn't recording both halves or something like that. And
so it would have been shit.
shit from here. I think I also lost one. Part of our process is I have to do a backup immediately after we do our recording because I lost a show once that without and I didn't have a backup. So my backup day is Saturday, the instant we finish Chit Chat.
Which is a good habit to be in because it means everything else for the week is backed up too.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I do use GarageBand a lot for the assembly of the show. I don't do the direct recording in there, but that's where I assemble the pieces, the bits and bobs, as you would say.
Yeah. For me, GarageBand is where I do all of the various little segments, like the Terminal Series for Victor and my photo diary for Victor's other podcast. That's pretty much all I do in GarageBand.
I think it's easier for doing... a single person recording, it's easier in GarageBand because you can stop and go, oh, I flubbed that sentence, go back, pick it up and fix it. But with these other, like Call Recorder and Wiretap Studio, you can't really stop and fix anything.
That's pretty much all I do. My technique is I don't write a script. I might have a few bullet points. I just turn on and record, and then I delete the whole thing, and I repeat that process about 5 times, and then by the 5th time, it actually comes out quite natural and accurate.
Exactly. Now, for writing up what you're going to talk about and blogging, what do you use?
For me, the only way I blog is with Mars Edit. I just couldn't stand the concept of using a web browser as a text editor.
Blech.
Yeah, I keep thinking I got to try Mars Edit, but I think the equivalent that it would fit for me is that's actually what I use Feeder for. So I use Feeder for creating the podcast feed itself and the finished product, but the show notes throughout the week, I do that all in Feeder. And I think that's the same kind of thing that you're using Mars Edit for.
Yeah, but instead I'm using it to really create text content. So I'm using it for my photo of the week in particular. So it's really good, nice drag and drop adding of photos into blog posts and things like that. So,
no, but that's what I said I use Feeder for. That's exactly what I use Feeder for. I write the 300,000 lines of text are all written in Feeder because it's a really nice little editor for throwing in, like with a single keystroke, I can say, okay, I want to put in a link, and I put in the two versions of the link, you know, the way it's going to look and the HTML, and it just pops it in there and does all the ahref equals quote crap for me.
Yeah, Mars Edit does that too, but is Feeder sort of a what you see is what you get interface or not?
No.
Mars Edit, okay, so Mars Edit shows you the HTML code, which is what I want.
Yeah, and that's what Feeder shows. And then you can hit preview and see what it's going to look like.
Yeah, that's exactly how Mars Edit works. So the preview is in a separate window and it's live. So as you're typing, you can see it change in the live preview.
Live would be nice.
Which is kind of neat.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that it has, so I can just select some text and click paste link, and it will take whatever's in the clipboard and stick it in as a link with the ahref crap, as you call it.
Let's see. I keep going a little bit further into there in what we were talking about doing the recording and stuff. I use an application called CamTwist. I think I've mentioned a few times. That's how I send the view of my desktop over to the whatever tool I'm using of the week, my broadcast tool of the week for the live show. So CamTwist is a critical piece of that in order for the people to be able to see the desktop. Now, we have a constant debate about whether they want to see more desktop or more Allison's face. Some people just want Allison. Some people are going, yeah, we're sick of you. Get off the screen. And so the compromise is I'm at like 0.7 size or something on the screen.
Yeah, what it actually does, if I understand it correctly, is it takes a live screenshot of your page and then presents it to the operating system as if it were a camera, so that anything that can take video input from an iSight can take video input from CamTwist.
Right, and it actually combines more than one source. So it takes my built-in iSight and adds it to the picture and allows me to move the picture-in-picture with respect to the desktop. So I can move me around. People go, hey, you're on top of something. Move over to the right. And I can move it live while we're working.
Yeah, so it's basically a software camera, but it presents itself identically as if it were a hardware camera.
Right, right. And so so that's for video. For audio, the equivalent of that I also use is Audio Hijack Pro, and that allows me to combine my voice with GarageBand as one audio input to the broadcast medium of the week.
Oh, of course, yes.
So between the two of those, and CamTwist is actually free, which is most awesome. Audio Hijack Pro does come with a price, but without those two tools, I couldn't add all the other bits and bobs together. So now you said you use, now how does Google Earth work into podcasting, blogging, and content creation?
Content creation. I am working on some massive projects with the aim of creating data sets for Google Earth, KML files.
Now, someday you're going to tell us about this, right? We've been planning a show on that for about a year.
I think it's all, it's well over a year now I've been working on this project. It's a big project. I'm basically mapping all past, present, and even indicating some future railways in Belgium and Ireland, and all stations as well. And there's literally hundreds of thousands of those, which involves lots of Googling and lots of finding resources online and then trying to tie it all back to the real world. It turned into a really big project. It started off as a little sort of, I wonder if, and ended up becoming a huge project. And I always put off talking about it because I want to have something finished. I want to be able to say, and you can download the KML file here, and I'm just not there yet. But when I am, we're definitely going to talk about this.
Okay, well, we'll leave that as the tease for now. Let's see. I also use a tool that's absolutely critical called the Levelator, and that's what allows me to not have to worry a whole lot about the difference in levels between Bart and I, for example. In Wiretap Studio, I could change the level of us with respect to each other, and I used to spend a lot of time fussing with it in there. But the guys over at the Conversations Network have created this free tool called Levelator. Runs on Mac, Windows, might even run on Linux. I'm not sure.
It's a Java tool.
Okay, right. So what that does, you basically take your audio recording and you drag it on the Levelator and it goes and it's done, and it actually just levels all the audio. It's like magic. This thing is so good. So anybody who's doing any kind of recording with more than one person, always use the Levelator, please, just for your friends.
I have a funny story about the Levelator, actually. A friend of mine started doing a podcast about classical music, and I immediately put him onto the Levelator because, you know, there were issues where I'd listen to his first episode and I was like, it really would be nice if it were all the same volume. But he's discovered that you need to levelate before intersplicing your clips of classical music. Because classical music actually really does vary a lot between being quiet and being very, very loud, but it sort of has to.
Oh.
So if you run it through the Levelator, it all comes out the same level.
Oh, no.
So he records all his voice, levelates it, and then brings it all back into GarageBand and then drops in the segments of music he's talking about.
Oh, wow. I never would have thought of that.
Yeah, I thought it was clear. There's a potential issue with Levelator.
Oh, that's great. Let's see. Oh, well, when I'm done with the podcast, I have to get it up to my servers. So I use Transmit as my FTP client. And I don't think there's a lot of interesting things to say about FTP clients other than you should have one.
Well, yeah, Transmit's also a really, really good one. It's not freeware, but it is a fantastic app. I'm a very, very heavy user, and it allows you to synchronize your preferences over Mobile Me, which is really important for me.
Because
I manage lots of websites.
You need to tell me about that, because I don't think I'm doing that. I need to do that.
In Mobile Me Sync, there's an option that lets you synchronize your... You know the way you get a drop-down of all the things you can sync?
Right.
If you have Transmit installed, you'll see Transmit preferences show up on that giant big list. You know, where it says, do you want Mobile Me to sync your contacts? Do you want Mobile Me to sync your email settings? All that stuff. And one of them in there will be Transmit preferences.
You know, I'm starting to think maybe I don't understand Mobile Me. No, I'm positive I don't understand Mobile Me. I could have sworn I had that in my list before, but I just looked and it's not one of my choices.
Well,
I think I ended up, I got my preferences back by just dragging the application support folder over from the old drive, from the old backup. But I'll have to go back and find out, because I know I had it before. That's definitely what I need to do.
This won't sync it to your iPhone. It'll only sync it to other Macs, which is why it may be of less use to you than it is to me. But again, it's about having lots of Macs.
But if I, like when I did the... when I did the Nuke and Pave, it would have come back to me through Mobile Me if I'd had it, right? Because it's sort of like a different Mac.
If you had them there the first time to go to sync on a fully clean machine, Mobile Me will say, okay, I haven't synced. What is the
we need a determination on that one. I don't know. Caused it to sync.
Sounds like water was involved. Which is not good. But it should ask you, you know, this is the first time you're syncing your Mobile Me or your Transmit preferences. Do I replace what's on Mobile Me with what's on this computer? Do I replace what's on this computer with what's in Mobile Me? Or do I merge them?
Okay.
And the right answer is usually replace what's here with what's coming from Mobile Me in a new machine. And that's how I don't actually import my library folder as a whole. I get most of my stuff back through Mobile Me. And then some apps I do individually, but only one app at a time.
Ah, right.
So just to mention, I mean, Transmit is not free, but it is a fantastic client. There is another client which is very good, not quite fantastic, but very good, and it is free, and that's called CyberDuck.
Yeah, I like CyberDuck, if nothing else for the icon.
It's very cute, but no, it's a really nicely polished program, and if you need an FTP client or a secure FTP client and you don't want to fork out for Transmit, I would definitely say give CyberDuck a go. And if you really get into it and you start to use CyberDuck a lot and start to say, I wish it could do X, then probably time to look at Transmit.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly the path I went through. I used CyberDuck for a long time, and then it was like, yeah, I just really need the grown-up app.
Yeah, the other thing it does that makes it very grown-up is it provides a ream of actions that you can use within Automator.
Oh, really?
So it publishes a lot of its functionality as Automator chunks that you can then use in your Automator workflows or your services now.
I have finally done my first Automator script, and I have it's almost working. It's actually it did help a lot with the production. Basically, what I tried to set up Automator to do is importing my audio into or running the Levelator and importing it into iTunes and running the little scripts I go through every week. I call them scripts, but I mean the script, like push here, click this, type this, type this. It's very boring, and you know, I just have to do it every time. So I've got most of it working. I still haven't cracked the last bit of code. I need Will to help me, I think.
Cool. But yeah, so if you need to do Automator that's going to FTP something, Transmit will give you all the pieces you need.
Okay. Hey, we better get moving.
Yeah, we've been very. Yeah, but this is the interesting one anyway.
Yeah, right. Let's see. I'm going to skip over the next one because I think we can fit it in the other place. But if we're talking content, yep, got to talk about Screen Steps. Don't need to say too much, but couldn't be doing what I do for my friends, for my family, for the fans, for the blog, for the podcast. Can't do it without Screen Steps.
And one I've included because I think it's an app that goes horribly underused is Pages. Everyone thinks of Pages as being Word, but you really, really shouldn't, because that's only like one of its tricks. You know, yeah, it's a pretty good word processor, but it's actually much cooler trick is that it is a basically a desktop publishing app as well. It's Microsoft Word meets Microsoft's what was that thing called? I can't remember it now. Shoot.
I don't know. I haven't gotten into Pages at all yet. I've tried to use it a few times, and I just like, eh.
If you want to make something that's an A4 size and you want to have a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of the other, like when I want to make collages of photographs, I just take a page, I open Pages, say, give me a blank layout document, not a blank text document. It just gives me a square canvas and I can put text on it. I can put photos on it. I can put fancy frames on the photos. Drag and drop, export it as a JPEG. Export it as a PDF and then convert it to a JPEG. It's a full, you know, if you want to make a flyer, if you want to make a leaflet, if you want to make a brochure, Pages.
I don't know. I tried using it to make invitations to my daughter and son's graduation party, and I just found it just tediously difficult to work with. I didn't like it at all. I didn't like read a manual or anything.
I use it for that kind of thing, and I find it fantastic. Well, you may just have to get into the mindset of it, but I find it really powerful.
I don't know. I couldn't even figure out how to get a box that was underneath a graphic to move separately from the graphic. I mean, simple things like that. I just like spent 15 minutes trying to just like change the size of the box that was, I'd made a green box, shoved a picture on top of it, and then I wanted to change the size of the box that was the layer underneath. Couldn't get to it. Couldn't do it. Finally deleted the whole thing, said, okay, not going to have a green box behind it like I wanted to. Someday I need lessons, probably.
Yeah, I was going to say, sometime when you're working on a project for real, you might do a screen share with me, maybe.
Yeah, that would be good. All right, let's talk about photography.
Yes, but quickly. I think we may have spent a small amount of time on this before.
Yeah, it's possible.
Obviously, it goes without saying, the two of us are Aperture nuts.
Woo! I used to use Photoshop Elements a lot, and I don't use it at all anymore. I mean, even some things like the other day I needed to shrink a photo down for my blog world thing that I'm doing that I got to send in my presentation and to change the size of the photo to physical dimensions, I just don't put it up in preview.
Okay, Aperture can do that.
Yeah, I didn't know how. I knew how to do it.
When you export it, I have export presets set up for all the sizes I care about, including the size for my blog.
Yeah, but they wanted inches. They wanted 2 inches, not 300 dots. They wanted 2 inches.
Oh, yeah, you can change. Sure. You change. There's a drop down there. You can make it pixels.
Too hard.
Okay. Yeah, I find that trivially easy. And generally speaking, you want to export for the same things. So you very quickly have all the presets you could ever want.
Yeah, but I wasn't ever going to use this preset again. I mean, it's not going to be very likely I need something to be 2 inches high. So I didn't want to go to the bother of creating a preset.
That's true. No, there's a lot to be said for preview.
Yeah. So you also have another tool with Aperture, right?
I am a huge fan of the Mapperture Pro plugin. Try saying that fast. Because I like geotagging stuff, because a lot of the photographs I take are of things rather than of people, and I want to know where they were. It's actually a really nice geotagging plugin, and I paid the $39 for the pro version. Ooh. And I'm loving it.
Cool. You have another one?
The other thing I use all the time, because at the end of the day, I'm sort of a big HDR nut, Photomatics Pro for tone mapping. I use it most of the time nowadays to tone map single RAW files instead of taking three and trying to merge them together and hoping that nothing has moved, because I've just realized that Ireland is too windy a country for that kind of HDR.
I've been intrigued following this. I know we have talked about that one a lot of times, but the evolution over time of what you ended up really sticking with and liking was interesting.
Yeah, so I used to take lots of JPEGs and try to make them into an HDR, and then I just say, hell, I'll just take a RAW, which has lots of data in it, and tone map that. That's worked out way better.
That's cool.
And the other thing I have, which people, it's probably just a me thing, but I'm a command line kind of person. I'm a programming kind of person. So there, as shocking as it sounds, there are image editors that are command line based.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
people.
Bart, this one is only you. This is it.
It's not actually only me. It's used an awful lot behind the scenes on websites that manipulate photographs.
Okay.
Because if you upload a photograph to somewhere and they use it as your avatar and they resize it, how do you think they do that? They don't open up Photoshop and resize it. They do it from the command line.
Ah.
So the chances are they either use GDLibs or ImageMagick to do it.
Huh.
So you can actually type into ImageMagick, you know, take this photograph and make it 50% of its size. And it's just a little command line, hit enter, and it happens.
Why wouldn't you be doing that in Aperture with your fancy little presets?
I could, but I use ImageMagick to do a lot more than that. I'm just saying, you know, it allows you to do commands on photographs from the command line. So I use it to create my fancy borders and my drop shadows and to put my credit into the images.
So you've got it as scripts that you've written in there?
They are little scripts, so I have a little script. Because if you look on my Twitter stream, Flickr stream, you'll see that I like a white border with my URL and then a little sort of heading, and then the Creative Commons logo, and then a drop shadow over the whole lot. So sometimes I don't actually want a title, so I just want a really simple one. So in that case, it's just throw in URL, throw in Creative Commons logo, throw in a drop shadow, and that's that. So I just have a bunch of these scripts, and because it's command line, I can literally say, you know, star.jpg and apply it to every folder or every image in the folder, and then upload them to Flickr.
That's pretty cool. It doesn't do the uploading, though.
No, it doesn't do the uploading. So my workflow is export at the size I want, apply the appropriate border, and then upload to Flickr.
Okay, cool. All right, our next category, data management, finding, keeping, and syncing our stuff. I think you're a little more into this than I am, but I'll jump in where I can.
Okay, so for me, the big one, and I almost forget about it because it's so seamless and it completely gets out of your hair, is Dropbox. I have every important document in a folder called My Documents in my Dropbox, and that same folder just magically appears on all of my Macs and magically keeps in sync, and I genuinely do not think about it. It just sort of happens, and one of these is I'm going to forget to install Dropbox and simply wonder, why aren't my files here? you know, it's absolutely perfect how it just gets completely out of your way. The other one I use a lot is MobileMe to keep settings in sync. And we've already touched on this with Transmit, but I use it for a lot more than just Transmit. And the other thing where you would know about it is that whenever I need to send you a big file, i.e. our backup recording, because something's gone wrong on your end, I send it through the MobileMe. So I upload it to my MobileMe and then send you a link, and then you can download it. So it's a really nice large electronic file transfer system.
Now, one thing that's great about MobileMe for that is it is wicked fast. I mean, those downloads are just crazy how fast they come back.
Yeah, I don't notice that on the upload, but then again, I'm on DSL. So
right,
so
the downloads
there is my up speed.
Yeah, the download is fantastic. Now, I actually use Dropbox most of the time. I probably should have put that up under podcasting, but like when I want to give a file to Tim Verporten for the Mac Review Cast, I give it to him in Dropbox. Most people who give me audio recordings give them to me in Dropbox, but it's pretty much the same to me, MobileMe or Dropbox. I find MobileMe a little clumsier, but it has the big advantage of you don't have anyone having access to putting crap on your machine. And I know that's one of the reasons you're not fond of Dropbox for that piece of it.
I'm not fond of Dropbox because something I control very carefully because I have to. I mean, broadband in this country is not as good as it is in California. So I need to protect my bandwidth and I need to decide when my bandwidth gets used. So with Dropbox, other people get to send you stuff at their will. So they push stuff at you, whereas with the MobileMe technique, I just send you an email and you then choose when to download it. And so the bandwidth on my end is fully controlled by me because I decide when to upload, and were I to be the receiver, I would decide when to download.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. That makes sense. One of the advantages to me with Dropbox is someone can give it to me and I don't even realize they're giving it to me, which is the part you don't like. But
yeah,
that's,
yeah, I mean, you have the advantage of much stronger broadband over there.
Right. The nice thing is, though, that somebody will send me a note saying, hey, I dropped something in your Dropbox, and it's already there. I don't have to wait to go get it. But like I said, with how fast MobileMe is to get stuff down, it's pretty nice. The nice thing about Dropbox is it's platform independent, at least Windows and Mac, so that's kind of nice. What else you got in here?
The other thing is I've become a huge Evernote user. I used to use stickies everywhere, and I used to wish someone would find a way of synchronizing stickies. Well, no one has, so I've just gotten over that fact. And now it's Dropbox for everything, and its searching is actually pretty damn good. So actually, it works out way better than the stickies ever could have. So when I'm in work or whatever, and I run into a problem and I find the solution, I stick it into my Evernote, and then the next time I run into a problem, I just simply type in one or two keywords like MySQL, you know, barfed or something. I don't know what it would be, and then it will pick out all the notes I've made, and I'll very quickly say, ah, right. So the command to do X, Y, or Z is simply this.
You know. Again, this might get back to the fact that I only use one Mac and I don't like to put anything on the PC at work that isn't official and all that. Mm. But I found I stopped using Evernote, and that was a tough decision. But when I moved over to the nuke and pay version of the OS, I didn't bring it over.
Didn't come back.
No,
it does actually have a web interface, so, and an iPhone interface, which are kind of good. And it is also Windows or Mac. It is actually cross-platform.
Yeah, I just found I wasn't actually using it. I don't know. For some reason, it didn't click to me. I don't feel like the tool is at fault there. I feel like I'm less of a geek or something, or I'm less of a person because I don't get it.
You don't have a need for it.
Maybe.
Because, I mean, the main reuses for me are, one, it's a place where I just dump those little bits of knowledge I don't want to forget, and that's one use, but it's not the only use I put it to. When I'm putting together show notes for IMP, because of the fact that the synchronized clippings is gone from NetNewsWire, I now have a note in Evernote for every week's show, and as I go through the week, I just drop in URLs into that note, no matter what machine I'm on, and then when it comes to assembling the show notes on Friday or Saturday, there they are all together. Or if I'm working on a long-term review of something, if I'm trying to write a blog post about it, but I'm not, it's not a short thing, I'm going to be working on it for a week or two, then I'll start a note in Evernote, and then every time something about it annoys me or something makes me go, ooh, straight into Evernote, straight in, and then when I come to the end of the week, I have a whole bunch of notes which I can then assemble into a blog post.
Ah, that's where I'm in Feeder at all times.
Yeah, but because you use one Mac, you don't have to worry about syncing. Whereas for me, I use three, so I'm always thinking about getting stuff on all of them. And that's why Dropbox and Evernote are so important to me.
Excellent. What else you got on your data management list?
Yeah, for me, I'm just lost without Password Vault. We've talked about it many times before, but I literally have 400 passwords in there. I couldn't possibly hope to remember them all. So without my Password Vault, I just wouldn't be able to live digitally. And the other one I had in here is Transmit, because for me, Transmit is part of moving stuff around. And so we've already talked about it, so there's not really much point in focusing on it anymore.
Okay, let's see. Now, you have a category that can really resonate to programming.
Yeah, this is slightly selfish of me, but I know actually a lot of people...
I'm just
going to
go take a nap while you do this part.
I know a lot of listeners are interested in this, and I'm not a believer... There's a lot of people think that there's like, you know, there's one editor for programming and it's the ultimate best. And I think that's rubbish. So I actually have four that I use regularly. So there's a great free one called Komodo Edit that I use for Perl, and it's a Perl IDE, and it does Perl fantastically well. It highlights every bleeding compiler error as I go, so instead of me having to write it all, then try to run it, and it goes, you have an error on line 4, it just puts a big red line under it, like as if it was a word processor.
Oh, nice.
And you hover the mouse over, and it says, you know, undeclared variable X, or whatever the error would be were it to be compiled. And it also has green ones like the grammar warning, which is, you've just declared a variable and you've never used it ever again. This is clearly not what you meant to do.
Oh, that's got some real intelligence in it.
It does. It's actually really nice like that. So it means I used to use other editors and I'd write, and then the first time I'd run, I'd say, okay, so there's an error in line 78, fix that. Oh, now there's an error in line 93. I don't have to do that run, fix, dance anymore. That's all out of the way, and the only errors left then are my logic is wrong, which unfortunately happens a lot too. But you know, no compiler can save you from yourself in that regard, and no editor can. So I'm a huge fan of Komodo Edit for Perl, because that's what it does. It's just a Perl editor. I wouldn't use it for other languages as much, but for Perl it just rocks. Another one I love, because it's a specialist one, is Text Strangler, which is a free version of a much, much, much bigger edit, BB Edit, which is like this huge, highly expensive editor that everyone swears by, but I just don't like at all. But it allows you to live edit files over secure FTP. So if I need to edit a configuration file on a server that I have SSH access to, I'll just fire up Text Strangler, and then it gives me a nice GUI for editing instead of stupid VI. Which is also going to get me hate mail.
By the way, if I did any programming since punch cards, I'd be really good interested in these topics here. No, I am interested in the way like Komodo Edit works. That's pretty interesting. I do use Text Wrangler, but it's more like I'm just poking at a little bit of something that's gotten mucked up on my web server or something like that. I would not ever use the word programming and Allison in the same sentence. In fact, I was telling someone once that I took Fortran 4 with Watt 5 in college, and that I actually never wrote anything in Fortran 4. And my friend Eric said, well, yeah, you did. You did your master's project in it. I said, no, I did not. And we pulled it out, and he's right.
But you don't remember.
I don't even remember.
In your memory, it was Fortran.
So that's back in 1957 for the younger people in the crowd here.
Wow, that's right at the birth of, you know, computing and stuff.
Lying. It was in 1957. That was a joke.
Oh, okay.
But it was a while ago. 78, 79, maybe.
Yeah, well, it would have been Fortran 77 then.
I'm telling you, it was Fortran 4 with Watt 5. So I'm positive. Fair enough. That I might have gone. I was in graduate school. Possibly it could have been. It could have been 1980 at the latest.
Okay, well, Fortran started naming their editions after the year, so you have Fortran 77 followed by Fortran 90.
Hmm.
And I don't think there's been one since.
But that doesn't mean we weren't back in time.
No, that's true. Anyway, the other one I'm a huge fan of is, again, free. And this thing is a beast, a monster of a program, you know, resource hog. It's written by, well, it's an open source project, but it has a big, heavy tie-in to IBM. And this is, if you were working professionally at programming, you would use Eclipse. And the Microsoft people have their editor, whose name Visual Studio. And for people who program Java, the Visual Studio equivalent is Eclipse. As I say, it's not lean, it's not mean, but oh my goodness, is it powerful. So, I mean, if you're writing big lots of code, you need to be able to get at the chunks of it easily. And if you have a 5,000-line program with, say, 3 classes and, you know, 50 functions, if you could just go to the side menu and say, give me that function, it will find it in the appropriate place and just send your cursor there, that'd be really helpful. And that's exactly what it does. So it knows Java so well that it can tell you where variables are declared. It can let you rename a variable so that it gets renamed everywhere. So you just simply change your mind and say, I don't want to call this variable X anymore. I want to give it a more usable name. So, you know, first name or something. And then you say, now change that everywhere. And it does, because it knows the structure of the program. It understands Java. So it's not just an editor that lets you type text. It knows and understands Java.
Cool. Yeah, anything else on the list?
Smalltron is then the sort of rest. So we've covered Perl, we've covered editing config files on servers, and we've covered Java. So what about PHP, HTML, SQL, JavaScript? All of that stuff, Smalltron. Small, simple, free, open source editor. It does syntax highlighting. doesn't do any of the fancy error stuff, but hey, highlighting syntax is good enough. And it's quite a nice, friendly letter to use. It's pretty, it's Mac-y.
I've been known to use it just to type.
Yeah, it's a happy editor. It's I don't know what it is about it, but it's nice.
It is. All right. We got to zoom to the finish here. We're almost done. Managing money. Yep. We better stop money. After managing money, I think. Ah, yeah. One you... no, we got more. Keep going. Quick.
Okay. All right. I use numbers. I do a bit of website businesses and stuff on the side, and I manage my invoices through numbers. I have a little template set up, and it just lets me really quickly type, hit print, and it looks really shiny because... Unlike Excel, Numbers lets you easily mix in graphics and things in a nice and sensible way. So Numbers rocks for making nice invoices. And as I say, save a template and just reuse it.
I actually use a tool called Mac Freelance that I did a review on it years ago, but I can put in how many hours I worked on something, and you can actually set a timer to say, okay, I'm going to start working, and if you can manage to work without doing Twitter for, you know, 15 straight minutes or something. Yeah, I know, that was a dream. But so you can set time or specific dollar amounts. So like for my advertisers, I've got a specific dollar amounts that I bill out. But for some of the freelance work that I do, I just do the hours, and it makes pretty little. I can have my little logo on it, and everything looks all pretty.
Yeah, it sounds good. I could get into that kind of stuff, and maybe part of me thinks I should. But on the other hand, Numbers is working just fine, and I never bill people by the hour. I just sort of do an invoice and say, that'll be £500, please hand it over. And I don't care whether it took me 2 hours or 50. If they agree to 500 and I agree to 500, I'm good with 500.
Ooh, you can end up killing yourself that way if it took a lot longer than you thought, though.
Yeah, but that's you learn very strongly from such experiences, and you suddenly become much better at estimating.
Good.
The other one, then, I would just be physically lost as to Ching. It's like, you know, Microsoft Money, only the interface doesn't scare the pants off you. Because goodness knows, my father tried to teach me Microsoft Money, and bless the man, he tried his absolute best, and it just didn't work. The moment he went to split transactions and double book accounting, I was like, Cha-ching is a Mac app. Shiny, pretty, type in things that show up on your bank statement and it'll tell you how much money you have.
All right. Does it show negative numbers when necessary?
Yeah.
Bummer.
No, the other nice thing is you can have recurring bills and stuff, and you can put future transactions, so you can actually see what money is coming out as well as what money is out, and hopefully what money is coming in as well as what money is in.
Oh, that's
so
good.
It's actually nice. It has keywording and stuff, so you can tag things. So you can track how much am I spending on entertainment and stuff. Instead of having to have double book accounting for everything, you just use keywords and then search on keywords.
Oh, cool. All right.
So,
and finally, utilities.
Yeah, I only took one in here because I use this thing every day, all the time. It is a real workhorse for me, so I couldn't not mention it when we're talking about programs we use for getting things done. It's trivially simple. It's a little app that lets you type in all of your SSH servers that you want to connect to. Basically make a bookmark of them, but it doesn't just remember the username and the server. It also lets you specify custom settings for a terminal window so that I actually make little backgrounds as JPEGs for all the different servers I need to go to. Red server means live, green server means not live, blue server means not a work-related one, that kind of thing. I have a sort of a whole thing, and I just say, this server, I use this username, this is the IP address, and I want you to use this background, this font, and this color. And then I just double-click on it, and it connects.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, so it's called Jellyfish, where the fish in the end has two S's, i.e. Jelly SSH.
And it's got that cool name going for it, too, right?
It's got that cool name, and it's a cute little icon, which is ironically not a jellyfish, but like a shell, as in shell oil type of shell. I don't know why, and it's also free and open source.
You'd think you'd want a jellyfish on that. All right, I'm gonna bring us home here with the last two utilities that I can't live without. Sketch. Sketch from, I think it's Plask is the name of the company. But anyway, it's just a freeware screen capture utility. I use it to take one quick snapshot, annotate, you know, put a circle around something, throw an arrow on and some text and a drop shadow. And that's actually what I use for most of the show notes. Even if I have an image that I'm going to use that I've created somewhere else, it's really, really easy to resize to specific pixels. Like I do most things at between 300 and 500 pixels wide. And throw on a drop shadow and it goes into the show notes. The drop shadow is probably one of my favorite things in there. Did you guys hear that? Screen steps, drop shadow. Want to see some drop shadow soon.
Subtle Allison, subtle.
Oh, they really hope to someday. But the other weird little thing that I've become addicted to is Zoom 2. And this is a utility I talked about quite a long time ago that allows you to grab a window anywhere and move it on the screen. Much like you can do a little bit more so in Windows. Not, you can't grab anywhere. But sometimes I can't get to the top bar of a window. It's slid off the top, or like there's some weird bug in Office 2004 that I'm still running where Excel files, the top is off screen. And without Zoom, I could simply not get them back. So I just hold down, I think it's Control Command or something like that, and I drag the window around, and it's Command Shift. Anyway, I can drag the window. I can click anywhere on a window and move it. It's way awesome.
Ah, and then you can move it down so the top comes back and then normality resumes.
Right. So that would be one of those things you would hate because it wouldn't be on every one of your machines and that would drive you bonkers.
Probably, but here's a question. Why is it called Zoom if all it does is move things?
Oh, no, it does a ton of other things. I just can't remember how to do the other things. It does all kinds of stuff. You can grab different edges of the screen to do different things. You can, you know, slide, you know, zoom out the window, make the window bigger, that sort of thing. I just don't remember the keystrokes for that.
is this one of those apps that make Mac programs maximize the way Windows programs do, as in actually maximize?
Might be. Like I said, it does this one thing I really need.
Involves making bigger.
Oh, yeah. Well, I could go back and read what I wrote about it way back when I reviewed it, and it probably says the answer to that question. But, you know, it's what is instinctive and part of your toolbox that you just can't live without that actually has made the cut for me now.
Cool.
All right. We've been going on way longer. By the way, Bart laughed when I said our top 10 apps. He said, oh, come on. We can't just do – or 10 is way too many, Allison.
Yeah, I was wrong about that. And I'm also glad I listened to you when you said we need to cut out this, and this.
All right, we better cut it off here. Are we on schedule for next week, Bart?
Yes, probably, maybe. I will talk to you later, but whenever I'm next talking to you, until then, happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind up the Nocilla Castathon for this week. I hope you enjoyed the long-playing version of the show. Be sure to get in your email to join the Camtasia contest. All you have to do is entitle it Camtasia. It can be upper or lowercase for those of you who asked. Just spell it right. That'll give you a chance to win one of the two copies TechSmith is generously giving away. I'm going to close the contest out this coming Friday. I think that's the 25th. Yeah, that's the 25th, and give them away on the 27th. So make sure you get your entries in. You can send your entry, your comments, suggestions, and the ever-important dumb questions to Allison at podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And next week, I want you to come to the live show, 5 p.m., GMT-8 on Sundays. And the URL is really easy. It's podfeet.com/live. No matter where I am, it'll always be live right there. Come join all the nutcases in there and have a good time. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.